comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. And those of you joining us for the very, very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. You know, this show is very definitely the show the audience built. Now, those of you who have been with me for the long haul, some of you have been listening to this show since I first began 8 years ago. And you remember those days back in Kosovo, and you remember me telling you about how cold I was. And you know all of the metamorphosis that we have gone through. But one thing that you know for sure is that the audience has built this show. And the specifics of that work like this. I get email from listeners who recommend that we get various people to be guests on the show. And I do my best to do that as quickly as possible. Now, you do understand that the guest has a say in that as well. Their schedule sometimes is just so booked that they just can't squeeze us in. I have had a couple that simply said, nope, I don't do talk shows. But usually the guest is glad to come on, but we get most of our guests have been recommended by listeners. I have to say that I truly appreciate that. And I also have to say that my guest tonight was not recommended to me through an email, but through a call that we received on a live show. And if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I think it was Paul from New York that recommended that we have Phil Imbrogno on. Now, I could be wrong about that because, you know, during the show, you can see now, I'm watching the TV channel controls over here. I'm watching the radio channel controls over here. And I'm watching the telephone controls over there. So I stay pretty busy, and you see me looking around a lot during the show. Well, that's what I'm doing. I'm monitoring all that equipment. And so I was talking with, I think it was Paul, but I can't remember for sure. And he said, you really need to get Phil Imbrogno back on the show. Well, I didn't say anything about it. I had not had Phil Imbrogno on the show before. But things were moving so fast, we just kind of ran over that. Well, the next day or two, I received information from Phil Imbrogno. I began trying to locate how to get in touch with Phil Imbrogno. I made a note when Paul said that. And so now I was trying to figure out how to get in touch with him, and I got an email from him. And I won't go into all of the details of the scheduling and so forth, but Phil sent me three books. He's published six books. He sent me three. I have read two of them. They are fantastic. And he's my guest tonight. You want to be sure. Open your ears, call your friends, and get ready for something really special. We'll be back right after this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network
is supplied by the independent artist from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
Show unique in the galaxy.
For those of you just now tuning in, let me remind you or inform you that you have, if you've just accidentally gotten here somehow, tuned in to the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Philip Imbrogno. He is a scientist, he is a science educator, and he is a UFO investigator, he is an author, and I think it is a great privilege to have him with us tonight. Phil Imbrogno, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, Kevin, thank you for having me on. I heard your opening on how I was recommended. You know, I don't know how this Paul heard me and what show he heard me or if he read one of my books, but it, you know, I heard what a great show you had, so I looked you up on the internet and I decided to send you a few books and talk about synchronicity.
Yeah. I was looking
maybe
for contact information.
There at work.
I was looking for contact information for you when I opened my email, and there was an email from you. So,
amazing.
Yeah, I think it was meant to be. Now, for those of you watching the Kevin Smith Show on our internet television station, I'm holding up a book here. Now, this book is called The Interdimensional Universe. I'm holding only one book up. I have three of Phil Imbrogno's books, but I only have two hands, and I don't have enough desk space for all of them. But I believe, if I'm correct, isn't this the most recent one, Phil?
Yes, Interdimensional Universe is the third series in a book I wrote about my investigations primarily into the UFO phenomenon.
Now, you've been at this for a long time, and you have worked with, and this is a name everyone will know, Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Yeah, that's true. My first book about UFOs, Night Siege, the Hudson Valley UFO Sightings, was co-authored with the late Allen Hynek, and that centered on our investigation into a series of complex sightings taking place in New York's Hudson Valley from 1982 all the way into 1995, where thousands of people actually saw an enormous object the size of a football field silently glide over major highways, causing traffic to stop. The sightings were reported by people who would not normally run to the police or run to a UFO researcher or a radio station, claiming that they saw a UFO unless they were sure that they had seen one. The sightings were witnessed by police officers, pilots, and scientists and from people from all walks of life. When you have that many people whose credentials and whose stability in the community, whose words, whose testimony would not be questioned in court, you have to listen to this and say, you know, these are credible people reporting something truly incredible. And Dr. Hynek called the Hudson Valley sightings probably one of the most significant UFO cases in modern history.
I guess until the Phoenix sighting, the Phoenix lights, that probably was the largest craft that of which there had been mass sightings. I don't know that that's the case, but in as far as I know, I think that's probably the largest craft that masses of people had seen. Would that be correct?
The description of the Phoenix sightings were very similar to the Hudson Valley sightings. But in the Hudson Valley sightings, the object was larger or just as large. And there was more documentation in the Hudson Valley sightings than the Phoenix sightings. For example, you know, July 24, 1984, the object in the Hudson Valley was videotaped over Brewster. And that's one of the few videotapes that was looked at by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And their conclusions were this was one rigid object, one solid object, very large. And that night, the object was seen by probably thousands over four communities. And it also was seen over the Indian Point nuclear reactor in Buchanan, New York, where it was witnessed by 12 New York Power Authority police officers. And these are people who are so well trained that they're sure what they saw before they panicked, because the object hovered above reactor number 3 for 15 minutes, and they reported it was solid in structure, and it was so large that they had to pan their surveillance cameras 180 degrees to get it in view. And there was a security shake-up the next day, and actually making that particular series of sightings public and writing the book Night Siege caused me quite a bit of problems with the New York Power Authority and the Air Force. As a matter of fact, I was the first civilian UFO investigator to be contacted directly by the Air Force in over 20 years and regarding a UFO sighting. If there was nothing to the sightings, why did they waste their time?
Yeah, exactly. What was their explanation for that?
It's just bizarre. And plus, you know,
Let me ask you this. Did you ask them that question? Did you say to them, okay, look, guys, if there's nothing to this, then why are you bothering to contact me?
You know, I asked that question and could not get an answer because, you see, the major who contacted me, I received an official letter from a lieutenant colonel first, and then I was told I was going to be contacted by the United States Air Force in regards to UFOs over New York. They did not want a UFO panic to start, and they wanted to know the content of my not-yet-published book, Night Siege, which was co-authored with J. Allen Hynek. So,
let me tell you something. This guy, Paul, that calls the show, called us one of his, I don't know if it was his first call that he told us this, but one of his early calls when he first began calling in, lives in New York City, and told us the story of having seen a UFO in New York, over New York City.
Well, you know, the UFOs were seen over New York City from the Hudson Valley area. So, you know, the sightings are still continuing, but not at a great pace as they were before, lower frequency. But, you know, a lot of other bizarre things have taken place since that time. And, you know, the Hudson Valley of New York is filled with with Legendston and so on. I mean, it's the area where the Headless Horseman was born and the story of Rip Van Winkle and so on. So now I imagine that maybe 100 years from now, the story of the giant UFO that appeared might just, you know, slowly fall into local mythology.
All right. As you investigated these sightings, let me shift gears and let's back up just a little bit. You are a scientist and you are a science educator. You have both a bachelor's and master's degree, and you've been a science educator for the past 28 years. How did you get involved, and why did you get involved in UFO investigation?
You know, that's a good question, and usually people who get rigidly trained in the sciences try to stay away from paranormal phenomena. However, my main interest when I was very young was astronomy, and the idea that there was extraterrestrial life out there, that the, you know, the universe was inhabited by beings, and there were, you know, UFO sightings taking place. They called them flying saucers back then, and the idea that these flying saucers represented extraterrestrial visitors fascinated me. So, you know, I read all the books back then and got an interest in it, and my interest in astronomy increased. Unfortunately, I got sidetracked by the Vietnam War. So, but after that, you know, I got a degree in astronomy, got a degree in chemistry, and I started to apply my scientific training and other training I received into my interest in studying UFOs. And, you know, so I think it's my interest in science and exploration, especially in astronomy, that triggered the interest in UFOs.
All right, so now here you are with I'll call it establishment training, scientific training, and you're getting into the investigation of something very much not establishment. Did you have any problems, any career problems as a result of that?
Not really. I mean, you know, in the academic circles, sometimes, you know, you have a little difficulty, you know, you get a little joke or a chuckle when you're at conferences from time to time. But, you know, most of these people who are, you know, my critics in the scientific world, they haven't really looked into UFOs and other forms of paranormal phenomena. So they're basing, you know, a prejudice on something that they think does not or does exist without even looking into it. You know, one of the greatest sins of science is to say something exists when it does not. But it's also a sin in science to say something doesn't exist, especially if you haven't determined if it does or not by investigation. So to me, that's not science. And I will ask, you know, how many UFO cases have you looked into? I would ask some of these people, and they would say zero. I said, so how can you make a conclusion as to whether or not this is real or not? It's not just, you know, some person who's, you know, looking for Big Brother in space and putting antennas on their head and going to the top of buildings hoping to be abducted. There are people who don't even care about UFOs that have these encounters. Credible people reporting something truly incredible, and the sightings continue to escalate over the years.
When UFOs first began to be of interest to people, and you know, it was a big deal. I guess really the beginning of the modern era in UFO interest would be Kenneth Arnold's report of having seen some strange craft flying above the mountains, and I find it interesting. He said, you know, their motion was they were just sort of skipping along as if you were skipping a saucer on the water. And so the press picks that up and invents flying saucer. And they've also invented little green men and a lot of other things that they chuckle about. They invent it and then debunk it. But that since that time, we have seen these, I mean, the first objects were apparently elliptical in shape. Kenneth Arnold's were not. His were more sort of a bat wing shape. But then we saw the elliptical-shaped objects, and then the cigar-shaped or tubular objects, and then now this Hudson Valley object. Now, how was it shaped?
The sightings in the Hudson Valley were primarily people reported as being like a boomerang shape, but also triangular shape. If you have an object in the sky at night and it, you know, has multi-colored lights on it and a great deal of lights, the angle that you view it at and the number of lights that you can see is going to determine the shape you think it is. So, for the most part, they were boomerang shapes and triangular shapes. If anyone out there has ever seen the Phoenix light, that sort of like arc shape pattern of light, we have a photograph just like that in color in the Hudson Valley that was photographed by a Connecticut state trooper. I mean, it looks just like that. And the analysis showed that from one end of the light to the end or other end of the half circle, it's 900 feet. So you're talking about an enormous object. Yeah, and Ken Arnold, he saw objects that were sort of like chevron shape or boomerang in shape, and he referred to its motion as saucer skipping across water, and the term flying saucer was born. But it's unusual that after that time, people started reporting saucers in the sky. But, you know, the United States government got so interested in Kenneth Arnold's sighting because years before, just at the end of World War II, they had intelligence that the Germans were working on an aircraft that looked just like that, a jet aircraft. And when the Allies went into Berlin, the hangars were empty, and England and the United States thought that the Russians got it first. So when this object was seen over the Cascade Mountains, the first assumption was that the Russians were using this secret aircraft that was developed by Nazi Germany and perfected it, and it was invisible on radar, just about, and they were seeing if they can fly into our country and get away from it. That was the main concern, why the government got so interested in UFOs back in the late 40s.
So in the beginning, they suspected that they were, in the beginning, they suspected them to be Nazi aircraft making incursions into our airspace. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, they thought they were Russians in the 1947, but they didn't realize that the Russians were, in fact, also having sightings and blaming it on the United States capturing this experimental German aircraft. But during World War II, UFOs were also seen following Allied and Axis aircraft. They called them Foo Fighters. So, you know, UFOs go back in history quite a way. But we don't see the close-up sightings, the close-encounter sightings, and the detailed sightings until the late 1940s and the 1950s.
All right. Just a little side note here. You mentioned that, you know, we thought it was Russians, and they thought it was what they saw, they thought were American craft. I talked about this and some other things with some Russian officers that I worked with overseas. And in the course of that conversation, we started talking about what it was like to grow up in the Cold War and comparing notes. And they were told all the same things about us that we were told about them. And, you know, they said that they were absolutely terrified because they had been told that America wants to come and take over Russia. And, of course, we were told that about the Russians. And a lot of the things that we were told about UFOs were similar, but the flip side of the information, just like what you described. Then when the Cold War was over, we found out that the Russian people, the government's quite different, but the Russian people and the American people really had a lot more in common than we realized. And it was an interesting exchange, very, very interesting exchange. Now, well, we've only got less than a minute before the break. But when we come back, I'd like for you to, I want to get into this book. I want to get into this interdimensional universe, the science, the new science of UFOs, paranormal phenomena, and other dimensional beings. Because you as a scientist have delved into this, I would like to hear from a scientist's point of view about these things that we've heard a lot of other people talk about. And I have wondered about when we start talking about other dimensional beings. I have no doubt that they exist. On the other hand, it is very difficult for my mind to get around all that and to think about what they might be. So we'll get into this book in some depth when we come back. And ladies and gentlemen, call your friends. Tell them to tune in. Now, I know you love this show, or you wouldn't be listening. So call your enemies that you really want to make angry and tell them to tune in. We'll be back right after this.
Yeah.
All right, we are back. During that break, ladies and gentlemen, during that break, I checked my email, and I got an email from my daughter informing me that my son and one of my sons and his wife have just presented me with a brand new granddaughter. So to Sean and Julie,
yay!
A little bit of applause. All right. Her name is Berkeley. Haven't seen her yet, but hey, she's beautiful, right? Phil, sorry for that little impromptu announcement there, but not too sorry.
Well, congratulations.
Well,
are you grandpa?
Yeah, I'm a grandpa several times. I am a grandpa. Would you believe I have a son that is the same age as some of my grandchildren? I have a son that's 4 years old. And then I have grandchildren that are right about that age. So I guess I'm a bit of a miracle man. All right, I'm looking.
You sound
in
like it, yeah.
I'm looking here in your book, page 64 of the Interdimensional Universe book. There is a picture that is very maybe the one you were talking about. This one is taken in Waterbury, Connecticut, May 1987. Looks very much like the Phoenix Lights.
Yeah, and you know, and I believe the publisher put in a black and white picture, but it's in vivid color with red, blue, green, and yellow, and white lights. And it was a spectacular sighting witnessed by state troopers and a pilot and hundreds of residents in that area of Connecticut. And it caused quite a stir.
Well, I would think so, yeah. Now, let's talk about this book in particular. Is it your opinion, is it your theory or opinion that we live in an interdimensional universe and that other dimensional beings do exist? If that is your opinion, tell us why.
It seems a logical choice now. You know, years and years and years ago, this sort of stuff with multi-dimensional levels of realities and existence would have been considered something that's just restricted to the outer limits in the Twilight Zone and science fiction. But now with modern theory and quantum physics and quantum mechanics, we're learning that the universe is not as simple as we think it was, that it's multidimensional, and it's been shown through mathematical equations the existence of 26 dimensions. And at a quantum level, at the structure of the atom, we have a phenomenon taking place that there's particles at the nucleus of the atom that leave the atom, that work their way out to the electron shell, and they've been termed mesons and other particles. There's no way that these particles should be able to leave the nucleus itself unless they're tunneling through something like mini wormholes or something. So there's a lot going on in this area of physics. Now, my idea is that it actually stems from what Dr. Hynek told me. Dr. Hynek was an astrophysicist. And when we talked about UFOs, I asked him, for example, why are UFOs appearing in areas like in concentrations, you know, all over the world in certain areas? And he said, we talked about the Hudson Valley sightings in particular, why a concentration in this location? And he said, look for windows. It was his belief at the time, and this was in the 80s, that UFOs came from what he called a parallel reality, another universe very, very close to ours, and that they actually create these portals or artificial wormholes that come into our reality. He said to me once, He says, you know, Phil, I would be very disappointed, he said, if UFOs just turned out to be somebody's spaceships from another world. He said, I think the answer is more exotic than that. And looking at the UFO phenomena, it's very, very, very complex because it's not just people seeing what has been called spaceships from another world. These objects seem to be able to appear, disappear, fold in on themselves, change shape. It's like they're not obeying the laws of physics for our three-dimensional universe, that they're merging in and out of other realities or other dimensions. Then there's all the unusual phenomena that is generated around areas where UFOs are seen. And this is why I started getting into all types of paranormal phenomena, and really now, you know, call myself rather a UFO researcher and a paranormal investigator, because UFOs actually fit in with the paranormal. But, you know, the whole
okay,
UFO
Now, let's explore that for a moment. Why do you say that UFOs fit in with the paranormal?
Well, because, you know, UFOs are outside a normal experience. But, you know, people seem to want to put UFOs in a different category than the paranormal. It's the paranormal. Many UFO encounters, especially when it involves close encounters and contact cases, they sound more like ghost stories than anything else, or people who have encountered angels or demonic entities or whatever. You know, many of these cases involve ice and all kinds of strange phenomena that attaches itself to the UFOs. UFOs seem to be a part of this weird reality that seems to be emerging around us. You know, so looking at those cases, years ago, I ignored a lot of what's called high strangeness. When UFOs appear and people have UFO encounters, there are cases we call high strangeness. These are reports and experiences that are outside the normal UFO encounter, if you can consider UFOs normal. And many of those cases I ignored because they did not fit into the norm. But I began to realize that they're a part of the phenomena. And when Dr. Hynek and I wrote the book Night Siege, the Night Siege is one of the most unique UFO books because it's an actual documentation of these sightings, of what people saw. In it are people's real names and who they are. And it's an exact documentation. There were many bizarre cases going on at the same time. People claiming to be abducted by an alien intelligence, people claiming that they're channeling extraterrestrials, people who say that strange-looking beings are walking into the walls and taking their family. When Dr. Hynek and I discussed these cases of high strangeness, he said, we have to keep them out of that book because you can't talk about these things and tried to keep UFOs respectable, and because the media would have a field day with it. And so many of these cases were kept out of Night Siege, but later published in my second book, Contact of the Fifth Kind, and then further analyzed in Interdimensional Universe, which is the new book that's been published. It just came out in August of this year. But, you know, all of these strange cases, these cases of high strangeness, how they attach themselves to the UFO phenomena, really perplexed me. So, you know, I had to think about Albert Einstein for a while. And, you know, Albert Einstein was puzzled as to all the forces in the universe, the weak force, the strong force, the nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, and so on, gravity and so on. He looked for a unified theory to tie all the forces in the universe together to have a theory of all and everything. So I looked for a connection between all of these experiences and tried to find a unified theory in paranormal phenomena. And the only thing that I could come up with which makes sense is that our reality is multidimensional, and most of the time we don't see these other realities, but at times they merge in with ours, and we experience all this phenomena. But it's been happening off and on for as long as recorded history. In ancient times, in the Middle Ages, these encounters were called supernatural, religious encounters, and so on. Today, in the 21st century, we're basically witnessing the same type of experiences, but we're attributing them to aliens and so on.
So, all right. Well, but now, it wouldn't necessarily be wrong to call them aliens if they're from a parallel reality. They're not from this reality, so they'd be alien to this one. Wouldn't that be correct?
Well, they'd be aliens, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But the
not from another place in this galaxy or in this universe.
Not from the physical universe.
Uh huh.
You see,
do you think there are some?
I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you that perhaps that a percentage of UFO sightings are extraterrestrial visitors. Dr. Hynek had, at the end of his life, had a little problem with that. He would say, you know, it doesn't make sense. Why would these guys travel all of this distance between the stars to come here, you know, to scare people, to chase cars, and to take some samples and abduct people, then leave? He said, you know, they have to be coming from a closer area. So, you know, some UFO sightings may be actual extraterrestrial visitors, but I believe that the majority of sightings that we're experiencing have to do with an intelligence that's probably from what Dr. Hynek called a parallel reality. And back in the 80s, when Dr. Hynek proposed this idea of a parallel reality, you know, string theory was practically unknown. Now we're getting this idea of string theory and how wormholes can form, and that there are 26 dimensions in the universe, in the physical universe, and most of these dimensions fold in on each other so we can't perceive them in our reality. And the thing is that who knows who's in these other dimensions, and they may be totally aware of us, and they may be here, and it could explain a great number of things that we have been calling supernatural or paranormal for many, many years. It may be that sometime in the future, we may understand more about these multiple dimensions. And what we're looking at now as sort of like in mythology and superstition and attributing all kinds of, you know, amazing claims to, it may be our science of the 22nd century or the late 21st century. Back in the 18th century, when scientists tried to figure out what powered the sun, nobody could figure it out. Finally, people said, it's supernatural. It's created by God, so therefore, human beings on this planet can't understand it. So they attribute supernatural causes as to the energy source of the sun. In the 20th century, the idea of nuclear fusion was found out and discovered and theorized and later proven. And now we have an explanation as to what powers the sun. But scientists in the 18th century could have never figured it out. We're dealing with the same thing here when we're looking at all of this paranormal phenomena.
All right, Phil, we have to take a break. And folks, we'll be back more with Phil Imbrogno right after this.
Georgia, you're a burning sun. I just want to stand in your light. Without your love, I just don't feel right.
Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet? No? Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today. Welcome back. It is the Kevin Smith Show, and I am your host, Kevin Smith. My guest this evening is Philip Imbrogno. And
Philip, I want to get into something that you talk about in this book, and that you even have some pictures of it. Some strange lights coming from the moon. What's that all about?
Yeah, for many, many years, centuries, ever since telescopes really got more efficient, astronomers have been reporting unusual lights on the moon. And it's been called, documented, and it's been called TLP, transient lunar phenomena. Astronomers even today have a number of theories as to what causes them, but no one has an explanation on what these lights are on the moon and who's behind them and so on. So there have been a number of photographs of TLP since 1780, I believe. The first one to report TLP was Sir William Herschel in England, who's the fellow who discovered the planet Uranus. And so some people feel that they're UFOs and that, of course, you know, the idea that there's a base on the moon. Okay, so, you know, if you're an alien intelligence and you want to keep hidden from the United States surveillance systems and the surveillance systems of planet Earth and their satellites and so on, you know, a good place would be on the dark side of the moon. And, you know, there's quite a few cases where astronauts have seen also lights in space and lights on the moon. So what they really are, I don't know, but UFOs, whatever they are, we have UFOs on this planet, and they're also out in space, and they're also on the lunar surface also.
All right. In your investigation of this, did you come across any information to at least, I'm not going to say substantiate, but at least to somewhat corroborate the stories that we've all heard that there are extraterrestrial bases on the moon, or at least one, maybe more. Did you run across any information that corroborates that?
You know, I did some research into that, and there was a book written not long ago called Somebody Else is on the Moon.
I have that
and,
book.
Yeah, you know, the author produces pictures of what he calls bridges and domes and so on that were seen on the moon with NASA photographs and so on. I think the evidence is kind of weak. We know there's something called TLP. Even the hardened scientist admits that there's TLP on the moon, transient lunar phenomena. Don't know what it is. I mean, my background is in astronomy, and besides teaching, I'm a staff member at a local observatory. And I've done extensive studies of the moon and, you know, looked for a lot of these things, but have never seen them personally. I tell you, one time I got a little bit of a thrill. I'm looking at the moon, and I see this circular, shiny, spherical thing moving across the full moon, actually. And I'm saying, oh, my gosh, what is that? I'm finally going to see some type of giant spaceship on the moon, and I'm getting the camera ready and everything, and I'm looking at it, and it's moving across the lunar surface, and sooner or later it's going to go off of the lunar surface and it's going to be in space. Well, it came out on the other limb of the moon, and since it was not in the moon glare, it didn't look strange at all. It was a weather balloon. You know, but I got pretty excited then. It was a weather balloon just moving in front of the face of the moon. About 6 years ago, I got a videotape from Japan about, and it showed these discs slowly flying across the full moon very fast. And they were taken by an amateur astronomer in Japan, and it made quite a stir over in Japan for a while. It was on all the TV talk shows in Japan, all the news shows about lunar stuff and everything. Knowing my interest in TLP, a researcher over there sent me the tape. And I looked at it, and it showed these round spheres every once in a while passing across the face of the moon. I'm saying, you know, with the moon's diameter, you know, this the face of the moon is over 1,000 miles, and this thing is crossing the surface in a matter of 30 seconds, or and sometimes 10 seconds. And I'm saying this can't be. So we took the videotape, and I went to a friend of mine who does some video analysis back then and enhancing, and we blew it up, and we enhanced it. And it didn't look like a circle on the low-resolution videotape. It started looking like a movement of flapping wings at the end of the sphere. Blowing it up more, we realized that they were birds crossing the face of the moon. So his telescope was pointed at the moon, but between the moon and his telescope, these birds were flying across the face of the moon. And, of course, with the glare of the moon and the low resolution of videotape, they look like spheres going across the moon. So you've got to try to look at all this stuff objectively. And when you're investigating, you can't really have a conclusion as to what you're seeing or not seeing or what you're going to find. Any researcher has to look at a case with an objective fashion. You can't be a true believer, and you can't be a total skeptic. You have to take each case with an open mind and just see where the data lies.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I say very often on this show. I'm on record. There's no way to back out now. I've said it many times. I don't believe in UFOs, nor do I disbelieve. I think belief is the same thing as faith, and that's over in the realm of religion. I think either they exist or they don't. If they really exist, they don't call upon you to believe. There they are. I say it often. That's like asking me, do I believe in doorknobs? You know, I know they exist. I'm looking at one right now. And so with UFOs, if they really, truly exist, there is evidence for it, and there is no cause to believe or disbelieve. You simply accept the fact. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, there are people, many, many people, who take the shortcut. They want to come to resolution on that question, and they take a shortcut and decide either to believe or disbelieve, when really what we ought to be saying is, well, you know, I don't know, let's keep investigating here. Now, you may disagree with that. I don't know. That's my view.
No, I agree with that 100%. And, who's ever listening, and no matter how skeptical anyone is out there about the existence of UFOs, there's three things that can't be denied. UFO reports exist, they persist, and it's a global phenomenon. And we have to remember that the U in UFO stands for unidentified.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dr. Hynek made a comment one time we were talking about investigating UFOs. And he says, one thing you have to worry about when you're in researching this type of thing is the witness actually telling you exactly what they saw. He didn't mean that, are they fabricating a hoax or are they lying? Sometimes when people see something they can't understand, their brain later fills in data and information so that they can deal with it. And if they think UFOs represent alien spacecrafts and they just see a light in the sky, their later recollection of the sighting may include both pieces to an object that they saw, which they never saw in the first place. So, you know, and you never know. For example, there are people researching the UFO phenomena, and to them, it's, even though they say, yes, I believe, to them, it's still like a game. It's something they do on the weekends, most of these UFO groups, and it's a hobby for them.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but they, you know, you have to recognize it for what it is.
Yes, but before you, you know, when you have finally see something you can't explain, then you realize how real all of this thing is. For example, during the Hudson Valley sightings,
Phil, we're just about to be taken into a break here. So let's pick that up on the other side of the break. I don't want us to get into the Hudson Valley sightings and the examples and then have to, you know, break off and pick them up again. So we'll get into the break, and then we'll, on the other side of the break, we'll hear the rest of that about the Hudson Valley sightings. Also, we will open the telephone lines and take your calls to Phil Imbrogno. On the other side of this break, we'll be back. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
in my life, yeah. Total mess. Thought you were about to crash. Drinking real hard. Burning out fast. I need you back. I need you back. I need you back. I need you back.
Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com.
All right, we are back, and we're going to wrap up with what Phil was just about to tell us. And then we're going to open the telephone lines. Now, the telephone number is in great big green letters on my website, KevinSmithShow.com. But for those of you who are listening by radio, you're not on your computer, let me tell you, the telephone number is 602-539-3316. 602-539-3316. When you call and you get put on hold, for those who are new, we don't have a call screener. I don't use one. So when you call, you get put on hold, and when you get put on hold, please stay there until we bring you on the air. All right, let's go back.
You were about to give us an example from the Hudson Valley sightings, Phil.
Yeah, what I was saying before is that, most people don't know that how much of a reality the UFO phenomena is. Because, most people are like, unless I see something, I want to believe, but, there's always a doubt in your mind. Now, the Hudson Valley area, we have thousands of people who are seeing this object, police officers, pilots, scientists, and so on. So usually UFO researchers do not see the UFO they're investigating. But on three different occasions, I had sightings of the Hudson Valley UFO, along with members of my research team, people who were helping me investigate and collect the sightings. We weren't out there looking for the darn thing. It just showed up in the area. Why not? Because, it didn't seem to care who it appeared to, and it didn't seem shy. So it was only logical that sooner or later, after spending many years into the field, we would run into this object also in the sky. Also at that night, there were hundreds and hundreds of reports when we saw it also. So, what I saw in the skies over New York with people, I try to objectively look at it and to explain it. But when you see an object that's lit up like a Christmas tree, the size of a football field, silently glide over the area of the major highways, causing people just to run and pull off the road and watch as this thing drifts by, it gets your attention. And this would really continued my interest in UFOs. And realize that if this object is so large and it does all this, and it's seen over such a large area, and if it's a solid nuts and bolts object, where do you put it in the daytime? It's something that's amazing. People
How many people saw this?
In a particular, with me, or?
Well, no, just overall in the Hudson Valley sightings, how many people would you say have seen this?
Well, a conservative estimate is over 7,000 sightings. And myself personally, I've investigated and collected reports, of course, with other people helping me, of hundreds and hundreds of people. We had so many sightings, we only picked the best witnesses. Now, in 1984 and in 1985, in response to all the sightings, people wanted an answer. And they weren't getting answers from the Air Force. They weren't getting answers from the local authorities and so on. So what we did is we held a public meeting in a school in Brewster, New York, which is in the Hudson Valley in Putnam County. Now, we really didn't advertise. It was free to get in. We were going to inform people who showed up about UFOs and educate them in the UFO phenomena, the history, and talk about the sightings, and people can actually fill out report forms. To our surprise, the conference started at 10 o'clock in the morning and continued to 10 o'clock at night. Local residents who never cared about UFOs before showed up, and by 11 o'clock, we had over 1,500 people show up, and the auditorium only fit 500, so people were lined out outside. And the local authorities got so upset, of course, the fire marshal and so on, and 900 people filled out report forms that they had seen this object, and people wanted answers. So it's interesting to note that something like this can take place in the United States, and although for a while it was carried on all the major TV stations and so on in the local area, that it could be slowly just pushed under the carpet and disappear into just like stories. I mean, that's what I find very amazing.
Well, I've addressed that previously on the show. Part of it is our fault, the general public, and part of it is the fault of the media. And part of it is, and this is purely conjecture on my part, but I think part of it is the fault of people who don't want to be known as controllers of the media, but I think exist. Because if they had a choice, let's say we had a Hudson Valley-type sighting somewhere in the United States right now, right at this moment. By morning, there would be reports of it around the nation. However, by afternoon, we'd be learning about Britney Spears' new tattoo.
Definitely.
And, if there are no controllers of the media, then I think it is just phenomenal confluence that happens straight across the board on the media, and it happens every single time. We know more about Britney Spears than we know about the geography of the world. We know more about Paris Hilton than we know about the moon, and the reason is because that's what the media feeds us.
Only in America. it's interesting because you're talking about certain things like that. You know, during my investigations, especially the sightings at the Indian Point nuclear reactor in Buchanan, New York, which was part of the Hudson Valley sightings, I mean, the people who saw this particular object, these New York State Power Authority police officers, incredibly well-trained, military backgrounds, state police backgrounds, actually scared to death when this thing hovered over the reactor, and they were under it. And the sighting was actually confirmed by the New York Power Authority. But the thing is that, you see, it caused me quite a bit of problem because obviously everything that happened at that reactor was now published in Night Siege. Later on, the show Unsolved Mysteries wanted to do a special on the Indian Point nuclear reactor sighting because it's one of the only confirmed sightings in which a UFO was spotted over an active reactor. They were going to go to an abandoned reactor somewhere in Pennsylvania and film this thing and film it for TV, Unsolved Mysteries. Well, one of the directors came up here and we went over the information and went over to the site and so on and so on and planned it. And he gives me a call about 3 weeks later and he said the producers got a call from we don't know who, but they killed the show. They said it's not going to air. And if whoever called, the producers were startled enough and had enough pull to stop a major production company and a major TV show from filming a particular show on UFOs and nuclear reactors. So there is a lot of interaction with someone in a very powerful position that controls what gets out in the media most of the time, especially with UFOs.
It's disturbing. We have grown up in this country, at least my generation, your generation, we grew up thinking that there was free and independent press, and that's one of the things the Constitution guarantees is freedom of the press. And when it comes to this UFO topic, however, what we find is that on this topic, if you want to have freedom of the press, you better own the press.
Yes, and you better be prepared if you have anything that's of a sensitive nature to be taking the heat from it. And I can't believe sometimes, you know, I made a lot of this information about the sighting at the nuclear reactor in Westchester County, you know, public. And the New York Power Authority came down on me and the NSA like a ton of bricks. I mean, I'm almost, you know, concerned to talk about some of the things that happened, including subpoenas and calling my school, stating that I violated something in national security. My gosh, I mean, you know, this is why sometimes that I find it very hard to accept that some of these people involved in the UFO field claim they have all of this secret government information that they're publishing and putting forward for the first time. I mean, I just touched on something of a national security and a nuclear reactor, and I got my ears pinned back quite fast. So I have to question a lot of all this other stuff and a lot of these books out that
okay, well, what did they do to you?
Information on that.
What specifically did they do to you?
Well, first of all, you know, when they knew that I was, I had to meet the officers in charge of the security secretly outside the base. It was a cloak and dagger sort of thing. They were very afraid of reprisals because Indian Point at that time, I don't know if they still do, they supplied the power to a number of secret government NSA tracking stations in the area, as well as providing power for the New York City subways. I got a subpoena stating that I had to appear in a closed court stating that I was told things by the security officers that violated the security of the reactor and that I was not to talk about UFOs and their sightings, and it was not supposed to be published, and so on and so on. I also got a letter from the New York Power Authority stating that what I did was illegal because the reactor grounds is a secured area, and I was taken to a secured area and allowed to listen in on certain frequencies, and that anything that I published had to be cleared through them or I could face some type of charge. You know, they even called my school I'm a science teacher, and said that I was involved with things that violated the security of this country. And, you know, the head of my school said, well, are there any criminal charges against them? And he says, not yet, but we're looking for them. So as time went on, it seemed that maybe the situation got under control. I was sort of backed off. They backed off on me. But for a while, the New York Power Authority and so on, gave me quite a bit of pressure. So, you know, and I
know you said this was, you said
like
it was
that.
The New York Power Authority, and
right.
I believe
York,
you also said the NSA.
The Regulatory Commission, the NSA, and the governor's office in New York. Their main concern, of course, they didn't even want to mention UFOs, that I was told things that would violate the security of the reactor.
And were you? Were you told things about the security of the reactor?
I was told some things that, in, for example, frequencies that they use, and I was shown some things about armament they have and things like that. Some things were revealed to me, but, you know, nothing that could have been really used by any sort of terrorist group or anything like that to you know, use against the reactor to attack it. I think what happened here is they were afraid of bad publicity because they actually panicked when that UFO came over, and there was a lot of things going on there that weren't published in the book. And after the sighting, right after the sighting, someone came in showing himself as Colonel so-and-so in plain clothes with a number of people, and they came in and they took all the recordings from that night, from the transmissions from the officers. They took all the video material. They had the object on videotape, and they debriefed all the officers and the supervisors and the commanders and said to them plainly, nothing happened. But you see, I was meeting some of these people secretly. And after a while, they were even concerned about their own security and their own futures, because they knew that someone very, very high in the government was trying to silence this entire thing. And what I covered in Night Siege is only a small percentage of what took place at that reactor during that sighting. A funny thing that happened, not really funny, but when the story that Indian Point had a UFO encounter came out, people who were anti-nuclear, anti-nuke people, bought 100 copies of Night Siege and had a protest outside the reactor gates and handed out copies of the book with the chapter Close Encounter at Indian Point marked. And they didn't care about the UFO. They were saying, look how weak the security is here, and look at these people who are guarding our reactors. They're seeing flying saucers. So that didn't go over very well also.
Well, yeah. But, you know, for a group like that to call someone else's credibility into question really doesn't normally carry much weight. And the reason that I say that is not because I think that people who oppose nuclear power are not credible people. It's because on the fringes of every group, there's always some squirrels, and they're the ones that get the press. And that's been the case with even those groups, and so they don't have a lot of credibility themselves, and so, you know, I find that kind of ironic that they would do that. Now, in your book, you talk about an experiment that you ran, and this experiment involved a tape recorder and CB radio.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that and why you were doing that.
Well, I was researching a case that involved a woman and her daughter and their family who had UFO experiences for generations, okay, grandmother, mother, daughter, and so on. And a lot of it was pretty bizarre. Whereas they actually claim to have had contact with some type of alien, non-human intelligence. And these individuals were terrified. It's something they did not want in their life. Well, most of what they were experiencing was done, most of the experience was missing. In other words, they would have blackout periods. The mother and the daughter would have blackout periods where they remember seeing some type of entity come into their house claiming to be extraterrestrial or whatever, and they black out. So, you know, when you hear something like this, you want to take it easy because you're not only dealing with a physical sighting, you're dealing with the psychological makeup of a person, so it's no longer really the realm of the physical scientist. So I brought in a psychologist who was very well trained in hypnosis and actually used to treat people who were traumatized by paranormal experiences. And we did hypnosis. He did hypnosis on this particular individual, this woman, and she regressed to a time where she had a vision of some type of entity over her bed as a child and started talking about her recent encounters. And we were taping it. And her daughter was in the bedroom sick at the time. But during the hypnotic session, her daughter came running out saying that, you know, the man from the hole, the alien, came in the room and was telling us to stop. So I had left the tape recorder, you know, going, and Kathy, who was the woman being hypnotized, immediately jumped out of the hypnotic trance, so to speak, and ran to her daughter. She was always afraid that whoever these beings were, they were going to come back and tape her, take her. So the tape ran for a while, and of course, you know, we ended the evening, and I turned the tape recorder off, but I didn't rewind it. When I played it back to some people I was working with at the time, I rewound the tape and played it, and on it, you could hear the hypnotic session, but all of a sudden, all of this howling and talking in a strange language came in on the tape, and this was not audible in the room. And I said, what the heck is this? And the people who I was working with at the time were interested in UFOs. They were interested in unusual phenomena. One of them was a police officer. One of them was a scientist, a biologist, you know, and I was the astronomer. And one of them was a journalist. One of them was an IBM executive. One of them was a pilot and so on. So when they heard this, I looked at all their faces and I said, I have no idea how that got on the tape. And you can tell they were like tears coming from their eyes, like they've never heard anything like this before. So there were electrical sounds and everything, and then a voice came on very clear on the tape that said, you know, stop playing with my head, we know who you are, or something like that. I took the tape to a friend of mine at the State University of New York at Purchase, and he was an audio engineer. And there was a strange language on the tape that, you know, nobody could decipher. He listened to it and he said,
Phil,
we
have to take a break. We have to take a break. I want to hear the rest of that story when we come back. Folks, is your telephone broken? 602-539-3316. If you have questions or comments about what we're talking about here with Phil and Brogno, give us a call. We will be back right after this.
And no one knew, no one knew.
am Kevin Smith, the host of The Kevin Smith Show. That's what you are listening to on radio or on the internet, or that's what you're watching on our internet TV channel. My guest this evening is Phil Imbrogno. And
Phil, when we had to cut away for break, you were just getting into this thing about the voices appearing on, or the voice appearing on that tape. I want you to continue.
Okay. Well, we had the voices on the tape, and we couldn't explain how they got there. And there was a strange language on there also, as well as, you know, a number of howling sounds and so on. But it startled quite a few of the people there and who were researching this with me. So I brought the tape to an audio engineer at the State University of New York at Purchase. This is a fellow who did a lot of taping of the shows that were there and the lectures and so on. And back then, this is back in the late 70s where they, you know, people still use reel-to-reel recorders and cassette recorders. And I played him the tape and I said, you know, can you make anything out of it? I said, listen to that strange language. And he says, that's not a strange language. It's English backwards. I said, what? He said, I'll show you. So he took the tape and he made a copy of it and he put it on his reel-to-reel and he reversed it. And it was English backwards. There was a message on there put on the tape from an alleged extraterrestrial from another dimension somewhere who was claiming all of these fantastic things about coming to the Earth with portals and everything, and that people were, they were taking people and experimenting with human beings and so on. So, you know, I was listening to that, and you know, it was bizarre indeed, and it was a little, you know, frightening at the time to listen to that. But I said to myself, you know, I played the message again to our research team at the time, and some of them got very upset with it because, you know, how can this happen? It's supernatural. It's magic and so on. I couldn't accept that. Recording tape is magnetic in nature. There are people in the past I've known from experimentation back there that have picked up electromagnetic interference on tape recorders because of the magnetic heads in the ferrite tape at the time could record an electromagnetic signal. So I tried to do, I did a little experiment. And I took a recorder and I took a CB radio. And I went in and I knocked it off frequency. I mean, I produced radio harmonics that probably were knocking out the TV stage, the TV sets in the area back then. And you have to remember, nobody had cable back then. It was all, you know, rabbit ears and antennas on the roof. So, you know, when I was transmitting this harmonic signal off frequency, I must have been affecting some of the TV stations. Well, using just the RF transmitter, RF transformer of the CB radio, which is about 4 watts output, I couldn't produce a sound on the tape. So, you know, I decided to take it a little further. I had a background back then in ham radio and electronics and so on. So I took what's called a linear amplifier. It boosts the power of the radio transmission by a considerable amount. Instead of pushing 4 watts and broadcasting over the AM band and the upper and lower sidebands, I transmitted with a power of 1,500 watts. And I was able to put my voice on that tape recorder. I probably was knocking all the TV sets out in several mile range. I was able to put my voice on that tape recorder and just as clear as day, almost sounded like the tape and the voice that was on the tape. And I could play music on there, I could talk on there, sing on there, and it sounded it didn't sound super clear like, you know, you're talking to somebody or you're recording directly onto the tape. It sounded a little distorted with electrical distortion in it. It sounded very similar to what I got on the tape. So my next assumption was this was a hoax. So I went back into the person's area looking for antennas, ham radio antennas, possibly somebody who was in cahoots with her and transmitting the signal to cause a UFO scare or an extraterrestrial scare or to perpetrate a hoax. I found a number of stations that were close by, and I actually talked to them on my radio in the car. And it was a custom back in those days that if you contact somebody and you're in the area, you know, you usually get together to check out each other's equipment, you know, the radio equipment and so on.
Yeah.
And you know, I went to these places and I couldn't find any equipment that could account for this, and they practically knew the person, Kathy, the witness, who was involved here. So I said, you know, a hoax is probably unlikely, but how do you get the English backwards, the message backwards on the tape? I said, well, you know, it could be done if you tape it, then reverse it, then play it over the air. It could come out that way. So I'm thinking about all these ways to explain this thing that was actually freaking out a lot of people I was working with. So everybody, some people were saying, oh, you know, the devil put it there. It was supernatural. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. And then I said, I don't care who did it. I said, whoever did it was obeying the laws of physics. We could duplicate this voice on the tape. Whoever was doing it was doing something very similar. They were obeying the laws of physics. It's nothing that was supernatural. Science could explain how the voice got on the tape.
I want to come back to that, and I've got a couple of questions about it, but I want to go to the telephone right now. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Don Constantini.
Yeah, Don.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, sir.
How you doing, Phil?
I'm doing fine.
Oh, you can hear me okay. Good.
Just barely.
Barely.
Yeah, okay. I grew up in Michigan, and I was a kid at the time of the 1966 UFO flap in Michigan when Dr. Heine first coined the phrase swamp gas.
Swamp gas.
Yeah, and at that time, the news media took UFOs seriously. It was being reported in the newspaper every day as headlines for over a week or so. And I was just fascinated by it. And then when Dr. Heine came there through Project Blue Book and coined the swamp gas, it just kind of blew everybody away. You know, it was just disbelief that he would call it swamp gas. Did you ever discuss that with him, why he decided to say it was swamp gas? I realized that, you know, he was employed with the government at that time, and he was instructed to downplay it. But did you ever discuss any details about that with him?
Oh, yes, I did. As a matter of fact, there was something that you did not discuss with him openly because he was so embarrassed about that swamp gas statement. You see, he was told by the Air Force when he was with Project Blue Book that his job was to explain these sightings away. They didn't care how he did it, but to explain them away. When he proposed the idea of swamp gas, he was actually pressured by the Air Force to come up with a statement, the Michigan sightings, he was convinced that they were authentic, but he had to come up with something because he was pressured to do so. And the swamp gas thing he did, he came up with. And today, and to the day of his death, he regretted that statement. And he said on Good Morning America one time, he said, you know, how long, working for the government, I had to stop it because how long was I going to go on calling all of these people crazy and insulting their intelligence? But that was a sore thumb for him for a very long time. He regretted that all the way to the time he passed away.
All right, let's go back to the telephone and to our other line. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Gary from Nebraska.
Hello, Gary. Now, you're one of the people I talked about that's been with us since Kosovo.
Well, Well, maybe not quite that long.
I thought you had. I thought you'd been listening since way back then. I know you've been listening for a long time.
I have. And thanks to Phil for being on the program tonight. It's you know, the stories, the stuff he's talked about is so interesting and exciting that I didn't want to call. I wanted to hear what he had to say. But thanks for being there, Phil.
You're welcome.
The reason I call is I've read the Celtic Mysteries of New England, which is a wonderful read. There's no way around it. And I also read Contact of the Fifth Kind. And it's not your fault that I felt it was unfinished, but there was a gentleman you wrote about, Dean Fagerstrom, and I always wondered afterwards, what happened to those journals that he wrote that were never published? I always thought that would have been a great book, but that's my opinion, not necessarily a fact.
Well, yes, Dean produced a number of amazing things. He's probably one of the few people who convinced me that he was in contact with something else other than his own imagination. His journals, the two manuscripts that he wrote were never published, The Book of Solarian and The Celestial Citizen. Dean produced these amazing technical diagrams under the guidance of a being he called Dinestra, and actually these diagrams are still making the circuit today. And as a matter of fact, I was just up at MIT working and looking at some of them with some of the scientists up there because I have a connection with MIT. So Dean right now is in a nursing home, and I've lost contact with him, but he was an amazing individual that actually produced something that would convince even the most skeptical person that this individual was in contact with something other than his own imaginations.
All right, now, Gary, are you still with me? No, he's gone. All right, let's go back to the phone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin, this is Kevin in North Carolina.
Hi, Kevin.
How are you tonight?
Good. What's on your mind?
To you. The comment earlier about the squirrels in the protesting groups, don't insult God's little creatures like that.
Let me really insult them. Do you know, I think you're aware of the fact that in my law enforcement career, I started out in Louisiana, right?
Right.
Do you know what we called them in Louisiana? Squirrels?
Get me.
Tree rats.
Oh, man, there you go. That makes sense. So, Phil, thanks for being on the show. And from another 30-plus year ham, I appreciate the effort you went through there with trying to figure out how they got that on that tape. But I wanted to ask you if you've done much looking into EVP, backward recording, or perhaps the Spiracom device.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I've been working with that stuff recently, and a very, very popular paranormal researcher by the name of Rosemary Guiley spent some time with me, and she brought me some EVP. Now, in the Hudson Valley area and some of these hotbed locations for paranormal phenomena, recently we've been doing some EVP work and have been picking up some voices and so on. But yeah, you know, stuff like that fascinates me. And, you know, the theory behind it is very, very interesting because I actually analyzed some of the signals that she had. And it seems that with this device that uses an AM scan, scans the AM band up and down, there's another voice, a very wide band signal coming in, writing in, piggybacking on the AM signals.
Okay, Phil and Kevin, we have to take a break. Kevin, you want to hang on through the break?
Yes, please.
All right. You're on hold, and we'll be back right after this. get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
iPod? Get K-Pods, the Kevin Smith Show podcast, and take Kevin with you everywhere. Subscribe today at kevinsmithshow.com.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. My guest this evening is Phil Imbrogno. And Phil was talking with us about EVPs. Let's go back to the phone line and go back to Phil Imbrogno. And let me allow you to finish your answer.
Oh, yeah. You know, EVP and different types of electronic phenomena that pick up voices and so on. It's becoming very popular, and some people are getting some interesting stuff. But it seems to be very limited. If there's anyone out there who remembers the old days of radio where you used to talk by skip, you know, skipping signals across the atmosphere, you can have a conversation, a short conversation with somebody over in Japan, and then they would fade out and not be heard again. This is what people are picking up on digital recorders.
All right, now let me ask you this question. Have you ever heard of a DVD movie that's out called Dead Whisper?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
You got to get it. Because they do something in this movie, it's a documentary type movie, they do something that I don't think anybody else has ever done. What they did, there was a psychic by the name of Robbie Thomas carrying on a conversation with a spirit or ghost or whatever. And what you have is you have Robbie Thomas, they've superimposed the EVPs they picked up. You have Robbie Thomas asking a question, and then they play the EVP simultaneous with the answer. In other words, you see Robbie ask the question, and then they show you the graphic of the EVP, you know, the audio graphic, and you hear it answer him, and then you hear him tell the people in the room the answer. So he was not hearing an EVP, he was hearing this spirit, but he tells the people in the room what the spirit told him, and then you hear the EVP tell him that.
Well, if I can interject, Kevin, are you familiar with the Spiritcom device and the talking with Dr. Mueller?
Yes.
Because that's what I was going to bring up, that's like this, that the thing about the EVP, as I've come to understand it, is that they need some kind of noise or electronic signal to superimpose their voice on. And that's right. Why some of the older recorders work better with the EVP. So they built this device, and for the benefit of the rest of the listeners, they contacted this formerly living electronics professor, I think he was, Dr. Mueller, who proceeded to tell them who he was, where he graduated, where he was born, and they went and verified all this information, and they actually talked with him, and he helped them improve on the circuit, telling them what was wrong, which resistor to change, and things like this. But this whole phenomena faded out when there was a disharmony between the researchers. So it's sort of like they crossed the dimensional barrier, but they did it through the harmony of all the researchers working together and kind of, I guess you'd almost say, wishing this to happen. But when they started accusing each other of things, it all disappeared.
Wow.
So I think there's like a human element to this, and I got to interject for you got to go on to the next caller, that I'm glad to hear, Phil, you talking about these other elements of UFOs, that there was a paranormal and other dimensional element to it, because I've known about that for years, but so many quote-unquote serious researchers will say, oh, there's nothing to all that nonsense, you're crazy. But to hear
exactly.
That even Hynek and them knew it was for real.
That's right.
And personally, I think that we're headed towards, I think what 2012, the big thing is all about, is that we're kind of headed towards a window between this dimension and the next one.
A dimensional shift.
Yes.
You're right on, my friend.
I'm with you on that. I think it's been going on since about 87, and things happen on a regular basis that remind me that it's gradually getting more and more and more, so...
Kevin, I want to thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, we're just about out of time. I want to do something. I don't know if this will work. You mentioned the guy that had drawn all these things in his journal.
Yeah.
And in this book, Interdimensional Universe, you have one of those drawings. Now, I'm going to hold it up for the camera. I don't know really how clear that is. Let's see. There we go. That's pretty detailed.
Yeah, but you have to remember that the originals are in vivid color, and they're high resolution, and they are of real devices, and actually one of these devices has been built, and there's 32 diagrams he produced.
Now, what do these devices do?
Well, they seem to be components of other devices, instruments, propulsion units, things that produce an electromagnetic pulse, three-dimensional viewing screens, something components for cold fusion, and also things for optics, and something called a high-flux resonator, which neutralizes electrical currents. And actually, you know, even though these diagrams were done in the 60s by this individual, it's not until recently that very hardcore physicists have looked at these things and said they are accurate and actually one of them was built and it worked, but it burned out very quickly. It produced an electromagnetic pulse.
And so they're part of a propulsion system? Is that what you're saying?
Well, some of them seem to be, but others seem to be devices to increase energy or produce energy or cause a resonation of energy. There's 32 detailed diagrams in vivid color, and they are some of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my UFO research. It's this individual that actually convinced me that, you know, certain people who claim to be channeling extraterrestrials, some of them might be, because these diagrams have gone with Dr. Hynek to Northwestern University, to Princeton, to MIT, and people were amazed by them. And I'll tell you, some of the things that are in there have given people ideas to develop certain technologies that are on the drawing board.
Well, when you draw something that amazes people at MIT, you've done something.
You're not kidding, because, you know, last month I was up at MIT, and it's one of the schools I graduated from. And, yeah, this is like, you know, a hardcore scientist who say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Well, I hear that, and it sounds so good. But I know that's not the case when we get into court. Extraordinary claims are made each and every day in the courtrooms across America, and people go to jail on what I call feather evidence. And, you know, it amazes me. There are people who have been convicted of murder, and they're on death row on evidence that you could not possibly have proven that they were guilty. Now, I think personally, in a couple of cases that I'm thinking of, they probably did it. Nevertheless, the evidence was feather evidence. And so extraordinary claims are made every day and get through our system, and reasonable, rational people sitting on the jury make decisions based on feather evidence for extraordinary claims. It's only applied, that maxim is only applied when we start talking about UFOs.
Yes, well, you know, even UFOs has come a long way. More people are experiencing sightings and having paranormal events, and so more people are willing to accept this.
Yeah.
It's no longer...
Tell us, we're up against the end of the show. Do you have a website address you want to share with us?
No, I actually don't use a website, but if anybody wants to contact me, I'll give my email out.
Yeah, do it quickly, because we're out of time.
It's bell1313@yahoo.com.
All right. Wish we had more time, but we don't. If you will, just stay on the line with me, Phil. And ladies and gentlemen, wow. Phil Imbrogno, get this book, all right? Get this book. It's really worth the reading. And all of his books are. This is the latest one. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.